All night I'd been inside my headquarters, listening to the wind playing demented tunes upon the army badges, eagles, and other paraphernalia that a publicity-conscious army commander had provided to mark the progress of our tiny expedition. I dressed myself in my heavy clothing before venturing outside. The wind blew with renewed violence as I emerged through the shelter's small flap. Each gust crooned a low warning that seemed to vibrate the whole planet before becoming the shrill, complaining shriek that penetrated to the center of my brain. It was a feat of willpower to think clearly. But I was the mission commander. Unless I was able to think clearly, we might all die. Others had been here, but only for a few hours at a time. We were the first soldiers to come. And now it looked as if we would be the first men to wage war here. It was a bleak, barren, metallic landscape like none other I'd ever seen. I looked up through the clear air and recognized the constellation of Pleiades, now setting. The neighboring stars were growing dim. I remembered how, as a child, I had dreamed of traveling to them. My second in command was an engineer. He was a balding veteran of many wars, a fierce disciplinarian with his subordinates. Even I was not immune from his sarcastic jeers about youth and inexperience. Perhaps that's why one of the boys dealing out the rations that day decided to complain directly to me. "This clothing isn't warm enough, sir." "You're wearing the same as the others," I said. "You'd be no use to the army in a cocoon." "Gee, it's such poor quality material. The cold wind goes right through it," he said, examining his white tunic with finger and thumb. "A profiteer with an army contract and friends in the Senate doesn't have to worry about how cold we feel." "That's all, soldier," I told him. "You volunteered for the trip, and your application was endorsed by your CO and agreed by me. Did we all make a mistake about you, soldier?"
"No, sir. It's just that where I come from, we never knew temperatures like this."
I looked at him. He was a weak-faced kid. He'd cut himself shaving, and a spider of dried blood crawled down his jawline.
"I'm not looking forward to the trip back, sir. And now the men say they'll be fighting before we return."
There had been mistakes and emergencies during the ascent. The boy needed reassurance. "It's a routine mission. It was 1,000-to-1 chance that they would have men up here, too." It was a lie, but it seemed to do the trick for him.
"There's no doubt about them being here, then?" he asked.
"They're not local inhabitants, if that's what you mean," I said rather brutally. I spoke too loud, I suppose. My second in command heard me and chortled. He looked forward to fighting. For 2 decades, he'd been in every war the army had fought, and he knew that it was the quickest way to promotion. I kept my eyes on the youngster. "Our mission is reconnaissance, but if they come into this area, we will oppose their transit. If that means fighting, we fight." I saw my second nod. He turned towards us. He couldn't keep out of a conversation like this. He prodded the boy with enough force to make him wince.
"If you don't like it here, go home," he jeered.
The boy flushed. That summed it up, really. No one could get back alone, so there was nothing to discuss. The boy turned to go, but he gripped him by the arm.
"Listen, Boot, did you wonder what those apes are doing up here? You think they came here to enjoy the view? Okay. Well, if they keep to their side of that," he pointed vaguely at the ugly outcrops of rock ahead of us, "then no one will worry them. If they poke their dirty faces around the side of it..."
He snapped his fingers in a way that left no doubt that it would be an easy fight. Perhaps that was the best way of reassuring the boy, and of reassuring them all. I said, "We think they are here for strategic reasons. From here, they can launch an attack that would raise our cities and decimate our women and children. They will have machines with them. Well, you'll see."
"Now get going on the ration details," said the second, and followed the boy to be sure that it was done satisfactorily.
When they had gone, I went to stare again at the landscape. The sun's orbit brought it over the peaks behind us. In this clear air, the light was redder than I'd ever seen. Even before reveille ended, I could hear the metallic clank of weapon checks. They were good men, uncomplaining and loyal. I hoped that the events of the day would not cause me to change my opinion of them. There was still another wheat cake left with my breakfast. I gobbled it hastily, knowing that I might not eat again for some time. I removed my helmet and wiped the sweat from my close-cropped head, hearing the sentries change with a lot of ceremony and feet stamping, and then finally my second-in-command brought the parade to attention and reported to me.
Special Mission 1 on duty, sir.
I returned his salute with parade ground precision. An icy wind bit into me as I walked down the silent ranks of soldiers. I could see from their expressions that they longed to get their circulation moving again.
At ease, soldiers, I shouted.
And then I waited until the first strenuous efforts to keep warm were over.
Soldiers, today you will make history that your children will read. Your children's children, perhaps, will remember your part in the history of our great nation. Free men will always be called upon to make sacrifices that freedom may survive. Some of my senior soldiers will remember other battles in Germany, France, and North Africa, where their comrades died in order that the younger man among you could grow up in freedom. Now you, in turn, are asked to do the same. We will prove true to that trust in us.
I had their attention. They had even to some extent forgotten the cold.
You are a part of the finest, best-equipped, and most scientific army that the world has ever seen. We were not sent here to fight, but we brought weapons with us because the government knew that these people who use the word peace so often, who profess to bring brotherhood and prosperity to the whole world, have nothing but hatred and envy in their hearts.
I paused, casually fingering the screaming eagles on my tunic.
The Commander-in-Chief has asked the Senate to rush a task force to our support. Until they get here, the eyes of the world are upon us.
These high-flown words held them wrapped for a moment while I issued a rapid series of orders.
Communications detail, report to your officer for special instructions. Special duty men, stand fast. Kitchen detail, break camp. Advance party, four made to move north under commander's orders. All remaining personnel on parade with weapons and entrenching tools in 5 minutes. To your duties. Dismiss.
They broke up and doubled away faster than ever before. The urgent attention to detail would drive all anxieties from their minds. My second ambled across to me with the insolence that a fine combat record permitted. He said,
"You think all that stuff does them any good?
Don't you?"
"Not a hope. But if it makes you feel better, okay."
He took out a flask and gulped a mouthful.
They don't believe that crap any more than you do.
He offered me the flask. I was very angry, and for a moment I wanted to remind him of my seniority and have him standing rigidly to attention and shouting affirmative monosyllables like a recruit. He must have read my mind, for he shook his head slowly and said,
"No, it's too late for that."
I nodded, accepting the flask, and took a long drink. I should have done that hours before.
"They know," he said.
"They know what?" He sighed.
"They know that our mission wasn't publicized. A couple of senators may know we're here, but the last thing they're going to do is send a task force after us."
"I suppose we both expected it to be like this," I said.
"I read the reports," he replied. "I've always said that we should have kept going on those babies 2 decades ago. Instead, the politicians put our name on a peace treaty with them."
He paused.
"I hate those bastards."
"There's too much to do to waste time hating half the world," I said. "Too much to build, to mend, to discover. We should have been working together all this time instead of the two halves of the world rattling swords at each other."
He spat and swore.
"You've seen combat," I argued. "You've seen what a modern army can do. How can you want to fight?"
I shivered. "Aren't the elements enemy enough? We still know too little about the world we live in."
"Ah, you should have been a doctor, or a lawyer, or an artist, or something. By Jupiter, I'll wait until you've seen these barbarians for yourself. I'll wait until you've seen what they do with our prisoners. Cruelty is part of their official policy, just as lying is. They have no religion. Nothing is sacred to them. Sooner or later, you'll have to face the fact that violence is the only language they understand. Believe me, sir, riot control in our cities, police actions against guerrillas or some tiny satellite nation on the far side of the world is one thing. This is another. We are going to come face to face with the finest soldiers they can select.
They'll have modern weapons and good leadership. I don't think we'll be able to stop them.
I'd never heard him talk like this. I realized that his brash and belligerent manner concealed a dark despair. They're not Superman, I said with a smile. They're just a mixture of nationalities from every corner of the world.
Like us?
Exactly. He was always talking about race and nationality, which made me wonder what his own origins were. The scream cut through the air like a spurt of blood. Three of our men, their uniforms mud-spattered and torn, were running as fast as Olympic champions. Behind them there was a fourth. He was holding his side as he ran, leaving a trail of red spots, each one bigger than the last. The whole unit broke formation as the three men of the advance party ran past them without even a glance at their comrades. The fourth man was level with me now, and I stepped out to stand in his path. He stopped. His eyes were huge and full of tears.
"You said they were men," he accused. "You said we'd be fighting men."
His voice was shrill to the point of hysteria. His helmet was askew, but the spider of blood on his jaw told me that it was the boy I'd spoken with. I grabbed his arm, but he broke away from me with a surprising force. I watched him as he followed the others down a steep incline, dodging between the rocky outcrops. "Come back," I shouted. The wind snatched my voice away. I cupped my hands around my mouth. "Come back at once. I'll have you executed." It was no use. The rest of them had sniffed the scent of panic and were scrambling down the hillside, too. Only a few of the hardiest old campaigners remained in the roadway, looking the way the four men had come. For a moment I had hope, but then they saw the sight that the others had seen, and they, too, gibbered with fear.
"Don't be afraid," I said. "Don't be afraid. I've seen them before. They are large, but they are controlled by men no better than us."
Two of my senior sergeants then prostrated themselves on the roadway, screaming a mixture of prayers and oaths that betrayed a mankind for whom witchcraft lay just under the skin of science. Other soldiers were ripping their hands and legs on the rocks and stony ledges below me as they half ran and half fell towards the sheltered basin in which we had camped the previous night.
"Alive!"
my soldiers were shouting.
"They're alive!"
They wouldn't escape. There was no escape from here. 1,000 feet below me were men who could have got there only by throwing themselves bodily from the narrow crevasse. Wearily, I turned back to where my second in command was standing. He'd not moved. "Who could have believed it?" I asked, as I stood there with the bald officer, just two of us between the invaders and the rich, lush land of Italy. Who could have believed that Hannibal would bring elephants over the Alps?